We're talked about the ecumenical councils. For those of you who are not here, I'll just mention them briefly. Sometime we'll do a little bit more detailed study in them, what happened in these early days. Someone asked the question after I finished yesterday. I thought I might go into that for just a minute because I don't think I answered it satisfactorily. How these councils came about or why they came about. There were a lot of reasons for councils to take place. Remember that the last of the apostles died right at the end of the first century. That was John. All of the rest of them had died before that. Paul died probably somewhere around just past the middle of the century, 58-60 AD, somewhere along there. And Peter, not too long after that, the rest of them went off the scene in just a rapid succession. John, being the youngest of the disciples, lived to the ripe old age, we believe, somewhere past 100 years of age. Tradition says he died at the age of 109. We don't know. But we do know this, that he did live into the first century, because we have an account of it by Polycarp. Polycarp was a student of John's. And when the apostles were around, they could always go to them and say, what do we do now? You were walked with Christ, or they'd say to Paul, you had this revelation. What do we do? We've got to have some kind of information. And so the apostles then said, well, after the apostles went off the scene, then these different men who had been trained by someone, they had a chain of succession in there, continuing in an apostolic order, such as Polycarp and some of these others. And these men were asked to preside over councils because there were pastors that were coming in, new men coming in, overseers, bishops, if you want to call them that, who were coming into the pastor of these churches, and problems were arising, and they didn't have any scripture on them. Or even at that time, some of them didn't even have a full copy of what we know to be the Bible yet. Now, these were Gentiles, remember, for the most part, and they didn't have a completed canon. The canons weren't completed at that time. And so some of these men like Origen and Polycarp and Eusebius and Irenaeus and some of these others began to write. Not only did they take the text that was left behind by the apostles, but they began to write commentaries on them. We've actually got almost a complete set of commentaries written by Eusebius right today on the entire Bible. Irenaeus was a noted writer. Irenaeus wrote a tremendous amount of material. Up later on, Augustine, for instance, wrote a tremendous amount of material on the Bible. I have six volumes of Augustine's works, and that's by no means complete. So these men were prolific writers. They had to do that. They were daily sending out messengers with these letters that went on. And every once in a while, things began to creep in, like the Arian controversy, where Arius began to teach his heresies. And they had to call councils. They had to get these men together and inform them all at once, because it was error has a way of moving a lot faster than truth does. And you can get a lie started, and it'll go from coast to coast in a matter of days. You can stand up in New York and preach the truth, and it won't go past anybody's ears hardly. But error does move, and they knew this, so they called these various councils, and they started very early. The Council of Nice, what became known as the First Nicene Council, was in 325. There were various councils that was early as 314, up until the year 381. The Second Council, that is the official council, was in 381 at Constantinople. In 431, the Ephesian Council at Ephesus, the Fourth Council at Chalcedon in 451, the Fifth in Constantinople in 553, the Sixth one was held at Constantinople in 680 to 681, and the Seventh at Nice in 787. And the second Nice Council, the Nicene Council, was the one where the creed was finally decided upon. It took a period, believe it or not, of around 450 years for this to take form. But in the meantime, there had been a lot of things happen. For instance, in the 4th century, a man, as I mentioned previous to coming in here and starting on this message, Pelagianism began. The monk Pelagius, who was a British monk, and believe it or not, he started teaching these things, and they spread over the entire world in a matter of years. And so these councils had to be held. They had to come together and to decide what they were going to do about these problems. Unfortunately, they got involved in a lot of things. You read some of these things that were on the agenda, Article 14 or Article 18, and dealt with some crazy thing like bishops marrying and they could be married before they were ordained, by the way, which is still true in the Greek Orthodox Church. If a man enters the priesthood and he's married, he can remain married. But if he enters the priesthood without being married, he only has a year from the time of his ordination to get married, or he remains celibate the rest of his life. If he marries and enters the priesthood and his wife died, he's prohibited from marrying again. But once he reaches a certain age, and he comes to a certain age, or he's been in the service for so long, then he's permitted to marry one, but only in the only respect he has to abstain from any relationship with her sexually, because she is to be simply considered his housekeeper and companion. And so they had a lot of rules. Now, where do these things come from? They go back 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. Athagoras, for instance, came up with some strange things concerning that, which I won't go into, but you read that, you wonder how in the world they ever thought of all that junk. And the thing that I marveled at was that they didn't pay more attention to the Scripture, because if the Scriptures had been promoted as they should, if the Scriptures had been preached, if they'd come to some early conclusion on the Scriptures, the errors wouldn't have happened. But because they were continuing, as I preached last night, the two kinds of tradition that you had in apostolic time was oral tradition, where when the apostles went in, they taught, and many things that were not written. I'm sure of that. Peter preached many things, Paul preached many things, weren't ever written down. You know, Paul couldn't go in and stay, for instance, preaching there 5 Sabbath days, which is probably 4 weeks, contained probably 500,000 times more than he wrote in those little letters in Thessalonica. So when you realize that these men had two kinds of tradition, one of them was to stop. The apostles never intended that oral tradition would continue. They warned against it. Beware of vain repetition, Paul told Timothy. Beware of these traditions of men, vain philosophy and deceit. But oral tradition went on, and these apostolic fathers began to build vast, vast volumes of things that they handed down their profound opinions on, completely ignoring what the Scriptures taught. And so we got the foundation of the hierarchy. This is where your Roman Catholic Church came into existence, through these teachings of the fathers. The morals, dogmas, and tenets of the Roman Catholic Church fill hundreds and hundreds of volumes. I was in the Vatican Library in 1963, I think it was, or 64, and was very blessed at the time. I had met a priest, and they were showing for the first time in several hundred years, they were showing Codex Vaticanus, the original codex. And I had a chance to go in there and spend some time looking at it. I'm by no means do I consider myself a Latin scholar, but I had some important checkpoints that I wanted to find out for myself. And I saw with my own eyes and was able to do some photographing, which I did, brought it back and transcribed and still have in my notes. But I went in there and I was amazed. The bookshelves in the Vatican Library and off the Sistine Chapel, the library is a tremendous thing. It covers probably, I'd say, an equivalent of about 8 blocks square, about 4 floors high, and clear down into the catacombs down the bottom in the basement. There are no doubt in there, no one knows how many, but there are millions of books, and most of them are early writings of Origen and Hippolytus and people like that that go all the way back 1st, 2nd century. They got all of Jerome's things, for instance, Hieronymus, who wrote in Jerusalem, and never have been released. Not even for the sake of scholarship have they ever released them, simply because they are their property, they are the teaching of the Father, and if they say the Father's taught that, then you believe it. But you see, what happened was that back in the middle of the 1800s, some very erudite gentlemen were going through some material in the British Museum, and that's how the anti-Nicene, Nicene, and post-Nicene fathers came to be written. These 38 volumes we have upstairs, Ken. And those 38 volumes represent the research that they did in the Latin, Greek, and Aramaic, and Hebrew manuscripts in what they call the Oriental wing of the British Museum. And believe it or not, dear people, there is so much more over there that's never been touched yet, never has been translated, never has been put into print, and God only knows what's in it. But we do have enough right now to know and to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt the error that I'll be talking to you about this morning. Now, The Textus Receptus, which is simply Latin, which means received text, is probably the greatest, I won't say probably, that is the greatest miracle of God's providence, how our Bible was preserved. There are so many minute details that go into the preservation of the Bible that would take a library to write about them all. Because we have a tremendous amount of information and literature all the way back to the apostles, it's fairly easy, if you've got the time, and the time is available, to go back and to read what these men had to say. And by doing that, you glean, because here and there, you're going to read them quoting a passage from, say, Colossians or Philippians or Ephesians, or you'll find them quoting from the book of Acts, or they'll be quoting maybe from Matthew chapter 24 and chapter 25, a chapter under extreme suspicion up until, I'd say probably the end of the 1700s. And then they began to find out that this passage was quoted by some of the early church fathers authenticating it. The book of Jonah, for instance, which the so-called modern scholarship has scoffed at. The book of Jonah is quoted by Polycarp, who is a student of John in the second century A.D. So we know that we've got a canonical book that was in existence and being used by the early church fathers. So it takes a lot of gleaning. And believe it or not, as far as I know, no one's ever done that. No one's ever gone back to see to trace that lineage. I've done only a little bit of it in this writing. That's the reason why I want you to know that what I'm going to give you is so minute compared to what is available that, frankly, I don't have the time for it right now. But somebody a lot younger than I am, if they wanted to take a lifetime work to do this kind of scholarship, could perhaps come up with some information that future generations would call them blessed for. It would take a tremendous amount of money, a tremendous amount of research, but it could be done. And these men, these thousands of men, wrote letters, they wrote articles, they wrote books, they wrote treatises and tracts, and they contained only phrases, fragments, sentences, sometimes even whole books of the Bible in their commentaries. When you go back, you realize that you've got these men quoting from two different texts. And it doesn't take long to identify them. You see, I don't have to go by what some modern writers tell me. I know now how you can identify the Alexandrian line and how you can identify the Syrian line. The Alexandrian line, by the way, this is very important to those of us who believe in the message of the Apostle Paul, because I'll tell you why. When Paul went out in his ministry, he went north and west. And one thing I taught back years ago, how many of you ever heard me say that truth always travels from east to west, and error travels from west to east? And you'll find out that when the message of the apostles began to go out, that Paul was sent by God. God sent Paul to the European continent. There was a man from Macedonia said, come up and help us. You remember? I stood by him one night. Paul really didn't want to do that, but he went. And as he began to go, I have every reason to believe, historically, I believe I can go back and prove to you that Paul did go to Spain, and there's a good possibility that he actually went to England. That Paul the Apostle founded the Church of Jesus Christ in England. Now, when these two men went out, Peter was the leader of what I call the Petrine School, Paul the leader of the Pauline School. Peter's message of works, keeping the law, the Israelitish Judeo-Christian message, went into the south, went into Africa. And out of that came a large number of manuscripts, what we call the Attic manuscripts, or the Alexandrian manuscripts. The other went north. The truth traveled north and started going west. And Paul himself carried that truth. And wherever he went, he wrote these letters, and he had men such as Tychicus and Trophimus and Epaphroditus and Epaphras and Timothy himself and Luke. These men were amanuenses. And you know what an amanuensis is? They were men who simply wrote down what Paul said. Paul himself could not write, couldn't see. He picked up his pen every once in a while, and he'd make some brief mention, this have I personally written to you, or you see with what large letter I've written unto you. And so Paul took these men and began to send them out with these messages, and they were responsible for the multiplication of these messages. Now I know they were duplicated, because in the Ephesian letter, Paul tells them, in the Colossian letter, Paul tells the people of Colossae to be sure to read the letter to Laodicea, which could well have been the Ephesian epistle. Now, the one they have their names on, the manuscripts that we finally have drifting down to us, the last place that circular letter went to may have been Ephesus. It may have originated in Laodicea. Paul certainly referred to another letter that either we don't have it or that could be it. And because Ephesians and Colossians are so similar in style and were written at approximately the same time with the same purpose, I have a reason to believe that they may have been that. One is more complete than the other. And so these men wrote these things, and they were copied. And eventually, around Mount Ida and Mount Olympus in Greece, there were a large number of monasteries that were founded there, and they contained the Pauline manuscripts, or what we call the Pauline truth. And Paul, of course, because he was a Hebraist of the first order, no doubt of the Sanhedrin, either in training or actually a member of it, Paul carried with him large scrolls of the Hebrew manuscripts, preserving them. Because you see, when the Hebrew manuscripts went into Africa, there were a lot of things that were offensive to the Copts and the Coptic religion. If you study the Old Testament of the Coptic Old Testament and read the Hebrew Testament, Old Testament of today, you're going to read two entirely different accounts. Would you like to know what the Coptic Old Testament ended up being? You ever heard of the Quran? All right, you read the five books of Moses and the Quran, they're there, just like they are in our Bible, and you're going to read the Coptic version of the account of creation of Abraham, etc., but you're going to see an entirely different thing. Now, the reason for that is you've got the perverted manuscripts of North Africa. They perverted everything, and when they finally filled it over through the Roman occupation of North Africa, finally filled it up to Rome, they were deposited there, became what we call Codex Vaticanus. Codex Vaticanus was adopted by Westcott and Hort as the authentic manuscripts, and they assumed because they had an older manuscript that it was better, and in the case of manuscripts, older is not better. They just simply chose the wrong chain. Now, the wording varies very little when you start comparing these men. When you do a comparison of these different writings, it becomes very evident which chain was being used. You have to know what you're looking for. But there are two basic chains that lead us right up to the present. One of these was used by B.F. Westcott and the other one by F.J.A. Hort, who are responsible for the 1881 version of the... I wrote down here, this is amazing how I had to slip the tongue. I wrote down reversion. The 1881 version of the King James Version. Now this version opened up a whole can of worms, 1881 did, because every one of the present translations that we've got today, if you call them that, go back to Westcott and Hort. Because men of today don't have the scholarship that the King James translators had. You read this book, Translators Revived, that I've got here, you're going to find that at one time, amassed in one place, God had the world's greatest Hebraists, the greatest Greek scholars. Look at John Boyce, for instance. Look at Lancelot Andrews. Look at Reynolds. Look at some of these men. You're going to find that these men had such a grasp. Lancelot Andrews alone knew, and we've got adequate information that he had perfected 15 different languages, and was right at home in something like 28. Now, not only had he perfected, but listen to what he was perfected. He perfected ancient Hebrew, as differentiated from modern Hebrew. He perfected Aramaic, Syrophoenician. He perfected the Koine Greek, probably the only man that ever did, because this man had access and had a phenomenal memory. And you go into every language that was known, like the North African languages and so on, Oriental languages, he was a master in them. And he was only one of dozens. And I'll be getting into that in a little bit, how they ran the checkpoints and how they kept each other from making error. They had nothing like that in 1881. Westcott and Hort closed the sessions, absolutely forbid their men to talk about it outside, and in secret perverted the manuscripts. And I can show you, I don't have my 1881, is that 1881 parallel here? Okay, well, it doesn't matter. Now, these two men headed up a committee to revise the King James Version. Here's what you always hear whenever revision comes out. Here's what you hear. Public demand has risen to a fervor, and because of the great demand of the public, we are now forced into... Have you heard that kind of stuff? I have never heard public clamor coming out for another version of the Bible. Not one time have I ever heard it. I haven't heard anybody saying, "Oh, we need a simpler version." Old people say that, are unregenerate people.
Make it reverent for the 20th century.
Yeah, we want it in 20th century Brooklynese. They want something that they can get down into a language that's slang. And boy, we've got it. I mean, when you read some of this stuff that passes today, read if you will, what's that, the Living Bible? I call it the Dead Bible. You know, it's the most amazing thing. And this guy admitted that he never wrote that thing seriously. He just got something that his children could play with, and it ended up in print. And it sold millions of copies. The New English Bible. I had 268 separate versions of the Bible in my library, and before I finally started selling it, it had gone up to something like 283, I think. And I'm talking about going all the way back to the Bishop's Bible, Bates's New Testament, Elsevier texts, the Erasmus, and so on. And Westcott and Hort had the material at their fingertips, had they wanted to use it, but they didn't want to use it. You see, the oldest manuscripts are not necessarily the best. If you read the record of the Nicene Fathers, you find that tradition already taken precedence over the plain teaching of the Bible. There are yet today hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of Greek manuscripts which bear out the record that the received text is the accurate text. All you got to do is do some research on it. I mean, you don't have to do like Pete Ruttman, just get up and rant and rave and call anybody that doesn't agree with you a nut. All you got to do is do some sensible, calm research and do it in a scholarly manner, and you can find this out. You don't have to call anybody crazy. You don't have to make light of them or ridicule them. All you got to do is do some research. And I don't think there's any doubt that Satan has a Bible, which from all outward appearances is very similar to, but not exactly like the King James Version. You see, he doesn't, when Satan imitates, he doesn't put out something that's an obvious fraud. He puts out something that looks so much like it, and the 1881 is very close. But the changes that were made were so minute that the average person never objected to it. Those that did, within a few years, the furor had died down. Now, it took about 20 years for it to happen. But you see, when you're dealing with eternity, 20 years doesn't mean anything. And Satan knows that. So it has all died down. And then in 1901, we come up with what we call the American Standard Version, which was almost, but not quite, what 1881 was. And then in 1914, we come up with another one. 1917, another one showed up. 1921, 1922, 1927, 1928, 1931, 1936, 1938. And from the year 1944 to present, there's been an average of 1 to 2 to 3 new versions coming on the market. Every year. Unbelievable.
Did you say that's 200 and some now?
Well, I had 268, I think it was, and it had gone to 283 by the time I got rid of my library. I didn't have them all. There was actually a woman's Bible put out in 1893, I never got a copy of it. Where they took all references to God in the masculine sense out and put in women. And their reasoning was that after all mankind referred to Mother Nature, so why shouldn't we call God Mother? Now we got another one out. Now, see, the Roman Catholics got another one out now, in which whenever you address God, you say, "Oh God, our Father and Mother." They've done it up good now. I said in something I just wrote somebody the other day, I said when the Bible scholars all come, so-called Bible scholars come out now, the National Council of Churches immediately jumps on it and comes up with it, and I said they're well known for shooting themselves in the foot. I said this time they blew their whole leg off. And it's interesting, isn't it? All right. neither Westcott nor Hort, now get this, this is a positive fact, neither Westcott nor Hort ever stated their belief in an inspired, trustworthy, and infallible Bible. Rather, they treated the Book of Books as if it were any other piece of literature. Westcott had a strong leaning toward Romanism, looked upon Mary as co-equal with, if not superior to, Jesus Christ. Both of them were masters of rhetoric, used many phrases of disguise, such as, I'll give you some of them that they used, transcriptural probability. Isn't that a nice phrase? Or Syrian recension. They obviously made a choice between two different texts altogether, and they chose the wrong one. And I'll tell you this, they didn't do it ignorantly. They did it on purpose. Now you take my word for that. I wasn't there, but I'll show you why I know that in a few minutes. The basic error stemmed from traditionalism and rationalism. Both men fell prey about that time to the theory of Darwinian evolution. Darwin, believe it or not, was a professing Christian, but he was a theistic evolutionist. And both of these men were of the Darwinian school, and they were theistic evolutionists, assuming that the Vatican manuscripts, Codex Vaticanus, was pre-Syrian, therefore free from what they called adulteration of the text, they made the fatal error of ignoring a vast amount of material that was readily available right then through many libraries of England, particularly the British Museum. They ignored, never one time did they consult Textus Receptus. Not one time. Didn't even make a comparison. Now, let's go back a little bit. We'll go back to a man by the name of Henry VIII. Very interesting man. Henry VIII came to the throne in 1509. And he embarked upon a course that led to the gathering, I think, of probably the, well, I don't think, the world's greatest library of manuscripts and books. He fancied himself to be a theologian, and he wrote what is called a Defense of the Seven Sacraments in the year 1521, in which he took to task a book that Luther had unleashed upon Europe called Babylonian Captivity, in which he really took to task the Roman Catholic Church. For this letter, this manuscript that Henry VIII put out, Pope Leo X gave Henry the title of Defender of the Faith, a title which is still used by every British monarch. However, his wife, at that time, Catherine of Aragon, who had been married to him prior to ascending the throne, was unable to give him a male child. And he soon sent his emissaries down to Rome to get papal favor for a divorce from Catherine of Aragon. Well, Catherine of Aragon came from a very, very wealthy Spanish family. The alliance between England and Spain was crucial at this time, and the only child they had was a girl child, and her name was Mary Tudor, who became the Bloody Mary of infamy. It's interesting that Henry had children by each one of his wives, and every one of them ascended to the throne at one time or another. And if you think God didn't have a hand in that, I'll show you why in just a minute. Henry finally got his divorce. He married again. He married a woman by the name of Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn was executed by Henry. She didn't find favor in his sight, at which time he married a woman called Jane Seymour, who died, after which he married Anne of Cleves, whom he divorced, and then he married a woman named Catherine Howard. He executed Catherine, and he finally married Catherine Parr, who outlived him. Good for Catherine. During all these years of turmoil, Henry was separated from the Church of Rome, and he'd set up in England his own church, which was called the Church of England. He was then, by his own proclamation, this is the title he took, and he called himself the only supreme head on earth of the Church of England, recognizing, of course, by saying that there was another head, but he wasn't on earth. And he retained a great deal of the Romish practices. He retained the theology. He had several men like Wolsey and Moore and others around him who were Roman Catholic theologians. But you see, along about this time, the Protestant Reformation was coming into full bloom in Europe. And manuscripts began to start floating in, and translations began to be done. And Henry made what I believe probably was the one thing that God caused him to do, but Henry, as far as Henry's concerned, he made a mistake. He trusted a man by the name of Cranmer. And Archbishop Cranmer was a Protestant at heart. He wasn't at all sympathetic to the Roman practices. And so he was busily engaged in bringing Reformation to the church there in England, but at the same time he's also involved in getting a Bible out that could be read by the people, a translation. So it was, he convinced Henry, I'm sure of that, and Henry had a hunger for immortality. He wanted to live and be known as a great monarch of England. Well, he's well known. There's no question. Everybody knows who Henry VIII was. And so he wanted immortality. Cranmer knew that, and he played on that, and he had a genius for finding the right materials, and they began to comb Europe. At Henry's direction, he sent out emissaries. He sent out prelates. He sent out bishops and preachers. And they went into Holland. They went up into Scandinavia. And they went down into what is now Czechoslovakia and Bohemia, Moravia, down into Austria, what was later on the Austria-Hungarian Empire. And they went with letters from the Crown of England, and they began to bring back carloads, literally carloads, of books and manuscripts and writings. And they began to be cataloged, which became the basis then, was divided up into three basic sections. One of these sections was the library at Oxford University, the Bodleian Library. The other was the library at Cambridge University. And of course, the other went into the depository in what we now know to be the largest library in the world, which is the library of the British Museum. I've been in that, and I tell you, friends, it's staggering. You can't comprehend what kind of a collection that actually is, and it's so vast that I believe if you set a team of 1,000 scholars in there right now that knew Hebrew and Greek and Syrophoenician and Egyptian and so on, just in the Egyptian section alone, in the Oriental section alone, it would take 1,000 years to separate all of it. And it's so vast. Well, Henry did all that, but what he did in doing that, they began to bring in manuscripts. And I'll show you how God and his providence work. Little known facts. One of the popes back in the 9th century decided that he needed to get some revenue in, so he began to organize and move throughout Europe a crusade to go over to the Holy Land. He could care less about the Holy Land, the Pope did. It was a commercial venture from the beginning, and he got all these valiant knights and shining armor and all these horses and all this provision and raised all this money to go over and to free the Holy Land from the terrible Turks that were there. Well, one crusade started, and the most tragic of them, of course, was the Children's Crusade, in which over 12,000 children died. Marching, or he believed that through their innocence they could go. This one pope after another did that. What happened was that some of these men going over there came back through Greece. And they stayed at these monasteries. Some of them, their armies were scattered. They sailed in through the Mediterranean and were driven out time and time again and were defeated. And many of them straggled back on foot, and they went through and stayed at some of these monasteries. They began to bring back scrolls and manuscripts and copies of the Greek New Testament. They began to find their way up. Sometimes they only got as far as what was Hungary, or sometimes into Czechoslovakia, sometimes into Germany. But they began to be deposited in, say, abbeys and little out-of-the-way churches and so on. And bit by bit, God amassed the manuscripts in Europe. Isn't that amazing? It took a period of 700 years to do it. But God saw that when the time came, that the man would be there, erudite men, scholars, men with brilliance such as Lancelot Andrews and John Boys and John Reynolds and these others. And when the time came, after moving on this ungodly man, Henry VIII moved out and began to gather this stuff, so that by the time these men came along under James, who was James the sixth of Scotland, when he became James the first of England, he was the only heir to the throne because all the others had died out, this man was moved upon and took these manuscripts and began to go into a translation. But before that, now remember this, Henry didn't want the Reformation of Luther and Zwingli and Knox and Calvin. He didn't want that, but he did want a national church independent of Rome. And as he sent out his emissaries to comb the world for the manuscripts and books and so on, he hadn't the slightest idea that he was laying the groundwork for the greatest work of scholarship ever undertaken. The first Greek New Testament was written about 5 years prior to Henry ascending to the throne of England. There's a publication printed in the language of the apostolic age. It was the first time since the days of the fathers. And what they had done, they had a man by the name of Desiderius Erasmus over in Holland was busy at work, and he had the received text, and he made his copy from the Textus Receptus. Erasmus was probably the most educated, cultivated man of his age, and every nation in Europe sought to have him as one of his own, one of their own. He was even offered the cardinalship by the Pope at that time, which he turned down. He was a scholar. While he was not a reformer in the strictest sense of the word, he did lay the foundation for much of the work in Europe that was done by the Reformation people. Luther used Erasmus' Greek New Testament as a basis for much of his own work. But the strange thing about Erasmus was his turning back to Romanism after having spent most of his life in the shadow of the Reformation. He held some serious errors, Erasmus did. But you can't question his scholarship. It was remarked by some people, they said Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. And Luther, of course, was probably the man that was most responsible for what we know to be the Protestant Reformation. 100 years prior to that, get this, down a place called Prague in Bohemia, which is now Czechoslovakia, a man began to preach, and he began to use a strange Bible that the others didn't know anything about. He had a copy of a scripture. And his name meant, in the Hungarian, meant goose. John Hus. And they burned him at the stake. The Roman Catholics burned him. He's called a heretic, but he preached salvation by grace through faith, minus nothing, plus nothing. He was the man that invented the phrase sola gratia, sola fide, soli Deo gloria, which means by grace alone, through faith alone, to God alone be the glory. And it was also his cry that went all over Europe, sola scriptura, by the scriptures alone. About the same time, down in Florence, there lay another man, Gerolamo Savonarola. Savonarola was also doing some preaching. And he was taking, believe it or not, Savonarola preached all of his message from the 8th chapter, the 6th, 7th, and 8th chapters of Romans. That's all he had. He had a manuscript. See, these men weren't allowed to read these things. The only ones that were allowed to read the Bible were those that could go into these cloistered places, and they had to go in there and maintain absolute secrecy. The Roman Catholic Church was so afraid that if a copy of the scriptures fell in the hands of the common people, that their whole empire would fall. It did fall. It did fall. That's exactly what happened. They knew what would happen. Now, this work of Erasmus, a long chain of work began through some men like Sternica, Theodore Beza, whose first, by the way, Theodore Beza's first New Testament was published in Geneva, Switzerland. I had a copy of it and was sent into Europe. Robert Stevens, the Elzevir brothers. The Greek text, which was first collated by Erasmus, was then improved upon by Stevens, and that became the basis for the scholarly work of the 1611 translators. Now, the work of William Tyndale. Let's talk about Tyndale for a minute. Tyndale was born in 1494, died in 1536 at the age of 40. Think of that, only 40 years of age. Yet in his lifetime, he accomplished the monumental task of bringing into English the Word of God. He was the first man ever to do that. Tyndale attended both Oxford and Cambridge, became very proficient in the Greek language, and as the Greek New Testament of Erasmus reached him, he got his hands on it. He was awakened to the desire of having the Bible in his native tongue. And because of that, he was being persecuted in England. He went to Germany. He went there and conferred with Luther. It is believed that he did his work of translation in Germany, and his edition, the first English edition of the Bible ever printed, was Tyndale's, and was printed in Worms in Germany between the years of 1525 and 1526. Now get this, this is prior to the printing press. And that Bible was printed by hand. Do you have any idea what it used to cost to buy a Bible, folks? The average working man in Europe would receive an annual salary to maintain his wife and his children and his home and so on, the equivalent of about what a Bible would cost. It would take 1 year of his labor to purchase a Bible. Not an entire Bible, please, but just like the New Testament, or maybe a few books of it. They were written entirely by hand. The manuscripts were eliminated. If you go up my office, you'll look and see that when Johann Gutenberg printed his first Bible, he printed what is called an illuminated manuscript. Those first Bibles were illuminated all by hand. All the capital letters were put in by color. They used to crush up stones like lapis lazuli, and they'd crush up rubies, believe it or not, and other precious minerals. The colors that you see in there, I have had some illuminated manuscripts of the lowlands by the monastic scribes dated back in the 1400s and 1500s, my own possession, that were just as bright and clear, the colors were as clear as the day they did them. And you look at that up there in my office. These are two pages of replica manuscript of the Gutenberg Bible that's hanging up in my office there. And when you look at that and realize that that was all done by hand, that it sometimes took, now get this, it sometimes took 11 to 12 years to write a Bible. You can understand something of the cost of it, but the men that did it worked for nothing. There were monks, there were men who, they had such a reverence for the things of God. One order of monastic scribes, actually, when they'd come to the name of God, they would get up, take their garments off, bathe, wash their hands, put on a completely new garment, and never write the name of God until they got a new pen, an entirely new pot of ink, and then only would they put the name of God down. Now, they had a reverence for his name. Today, we hear all this stuff about who God is and his name bandied around as if he's an old friend. Well, he's a man upstairs, you know. Come a long way, haven't we? All right. Erasmus did this work. Tyndale was born in 1494, died in 1536 at the age of 40, and he put the Bible, the New Testament, in English. Now, when he was persecuted in England, he went to Germany, talked with Luther, conferred with him. His first New Testament was printed in Worms in 1525-26. Now, after his work was smuggled into England by some merchant friends of his, Tyndale thought it was safe enough to come out in the open because his Bible was being received, but what he didn't know was that at that time, they were after him. He had a price on his head. So he went to Antwerp. He settled there to continue writing, and he wrote a book called The Obedience of the Christian Man. I had a copy of that at one time, and had such a great impact upon England, so much so that the authorities were aroused and became a man with a real price on his head. They, dead or alive, they wanted him. So he was in prison. He was tried for treason and heresy, for simply getting a Bible into English. He was convicted, they strangled him, they burned him at the stake in the prison yard at Velvoorde Prison right outside of Brussels. I've stood in the very spot where he died, October the 6th, 1536. Tyndale had kept the Textus Receptus alive, the only man of his day that could have done it, and that translation then became the torch that set England on fire. The first complete translation of the Bible into English came about by a man by the name of Miles Coverdale. 6 years prior to the birth of Tyndale, now get this, notice the order, how the time overlaps, how each man comes on the scene at just the right time. They overlap each other. 6 years prior to the birth of William Tyndale, there was born at Coverham, Yorkshire, a boy by the name of Miles Coverdale. He'd have to be young if he's born there, wasn't he? This young man studied at Cambridge, became an evangelical preacher around 1528, left England for the continent, where he spent the next 7 years working on the first complete Bible ever to be printed in the English language, plus the fact that, you remember I mentioned Cranmer, who was the confidant of Henry VIII? Well, Cranmer's Bible needed revision, and so he spent about 8 years doing the revision work on Cranmer's Bible, and that became known then as the Great Bible. Cranmer was later burned at the stake in Oxford, at the very same spot where two others were burned, Ridley and Latimer. There's a monument there today where these three men Cranmer, Ridley, and Latimer were all burned. They were martyred. It was strange enough, now get this, that in the union between Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, they had a girl child. Her name was Mary. She was a Catholic. And she hated the Reformation. She hated the reformers with a passion. She had this man burned when she came to the throne. She had been laying for him for years. When she came to the throne, she burned him because of his Reformation principles. So now you have the stage set for all the coming events, which transpired when James I of Scotland came to the English throne in 1603. James was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. The death of Elizabeth in England, Elizabeth was the daughter of Henry VIII by his second wife, Anne Boleyn. There was no heir to the Tudor throne closer than James VI of Scotland. And so he became James I of England, and he became the man, humanly speaking, responsible for what is now is called the King James Bible, or the Authorized Version. Now, in our next session, which we'll have in just a few minutes, I want to go back and take you on a little excursion. We're going to go back and talk about a man by the name of John Wycliffe. How many of you ever read the story of John Wycliffe? Well, I'm reprinting that, by the way. It needs to be reprinted. You cannot find, I called the Mobile Public Library and I said, would you please tell me, do you have a copy of the life of John Wycliffe? And the woman said, who? I said, John Wycliffe. She said, well, is he an American or what? I said, no, he was English. And she said, well, we don't have a lot of material on English people. Well, I'll look and see. I said, just look under Wycliffe. She came back, no, sir, we don't have anything like that. I called the University of South Alabama. I said, do you happen to have the biography of John Wycliffe out there? No, sir, we don't have it in file. Not in our Rolodex, it wasn't in the microfilm phase. It's amazing. And here, I guarantee you, the fact that you're sitting right here, right now, in this room, listening to me speak, you owe it to John Wycliffe. Believe me. That's how important he is. So in the next few minutes, we're going to start talking about him. All right, let's take a little break.